back on the Rule of Three. Tim Slagle here in Chicago. Brian Miller on the other side. Two comics, three topics, 10 minutes each. The perfect podcast for your modern lifestyle. And we're going to be talking about the Golden Globes later in the show. We're also going to be talking about a comic who apparently pulled a scam on the media. But right now, I think the pressing issue, it's the one everybody's talking about in Washington, D.C., or I assume, is whether or not the Republicans will be able to repeal Obamacare. And the issue is that Congress has been running on this for at least as long as Obamacare has been pitched. I would say
2010.
2010,
Even though I don't believe actual Obamacare had been instituted yet, the fact that it was going to be was the 2010.
I thought it was 2009 was when.
Did it get started that early?
Yeah, I think is when it was signed into law. I think was it? No, maybe no. No, I think you're right. I think 2010.
Yeah, but either way, that was his sort of one of his top priorities, and then one of the.
You're right. I think it was spring of 2010 that it was signed into law, and it gave Congress something to campaign of over in the fall.
At least in this case, both sides are campaigning on something that is legitimate policy with an ideological difference that affects people. It's an upsetting debate because nothing ever seems to happen. But I mean, you know what I mean? Like, better this than Bill Clinton slept with an intern, or, you know, George Bush's National Guard records, or I don't know, whatever.
Like, no, all the stuff that normally fills the pages, the stuff that people are more interested in. You know,
this is like what they're supposed to be fighting about, right?
Policy is not really interesting. It's we all know the adage about sausages and laws, and it's I defy anyone that thinks that they're interested in politics to actually take a bill and read it from front to back.
Oh, it's brutal. Yeah, absolutely.
It's I was talking that I was typing. Is that somebody was complaining about having a president that we're going to have a president that speaks in 140 character sentences. And it was my speculation that I kind of like legislation that's limited to 140 characters. It's God was able to do it.
Yeah, but like Trump, he's mostly made up.
But it's, you know, laws that we need, you can say in 140 characters. Murder is bad.
Yeah, but not really. I mean, the problem with any kind of – the real difficulty with any law is that the incredible complexity. You know, like the trick to – a friend of mine was interesting, was a writer, and then she became a lawyer. And she said she became a lawyer because she was so excited about writing. And I was like, what do you mean? And she said, well, legal writing is the most impactful writing because it has the most direct antecedent in the real world. Like, you use X words and you have to be really careful because then those words have a direct physical corollary or whatever. And so then the trick of the law turns to it. I understand why it's so complex, I guess. It's nothing is that easy.
You know what, another interesting thing is an attorney friend of mine pointed out is that you know in comedy, if you write a bit, that's yours. That is yours. And even if somebody writes something similar, they're given grief over it. It's like, you know, such and such has been doing that for several years now, doing the same exact thing. It's like, oh dang.
Right.
I never saw him do it, but I'm not going to, I can't, you know, and that's the way it is. In the legal industry, it's the exact opposite, is that you want to write a clause that is so airtight, that is so perfectly worded that everyone steals it.
Yeah, I know. I can see that.
And there is no royalties on contracts. If you write a really tight contract, everybody's going to be using the same contract.
That's interesting. So basically, that'd be your fame, is like, you know, he's the author of the Slagle contract template. Slagle contract. I use that all the time. Yeah. That also sounds like a Robert Ludlum novel, the Slagle contract.
So yeah, it is interesting. And you know, but that necessity, that yes, it is a necessity in the modern world, but it wasn't borne out by it wasn't organic. It wasn't, you know, originally that this is that we have to be that so careful about the way things are worded and where the commas are placed and where whether each, you know, the words that are capitalized and the ones that are not. It wasn't originally that complicated. What happened was lawyers started pulling stuff apart.
It's only been
the centuries of lawyers analyzing and going over, you know, did you mean this? Did you mean that? You know, it's time to eat, Grandma. Yeah, you know, it's there should have been a comma.
Right.
I hate to tell you, Mrs. Jones.
Right.
Legally, you requested that activity.
Classic English major joke.
Yeah. So anyway, back to it. Yes, it is now the very mundane process comes of the. I think it was the Obamacare law was around 70,000 pages.
Oh, and obviously that's. I mean, the healthcare is so staggeringly complicated. I'm not really convinced that anyone actually understands the healthcare system, either how it really works or how to fix it or. I really don't think anyone knows.
Have you ever read I, Pencil?
I don't know what that is.
I don't want to misquote who wrote it. It is Hazlitt, I think, wrote it. It was either Hazlitt or Friedman wrote it. It's a little story about the pencil. And it's spoken in first person by the pencil. And it's, you think that I'm a very simple device. And then it goes through all the steps that are required to make a simple pencil. And then explains that there is no one on earth that can actually go into the woods and come out with a pencil.
I am familiar with that. I have read that, actually. And it came up in the context of a guy who said he basically decided he was going to build a toaster. He's going to make his own toaster, which sounds like, okay. And he did this TED talk on it. It was this incredibly arduous process that basically like same thing. Like almost nobody can just make a toaster.
Yeah. Yeah. There is no professor on Gilligan's Island.
Yes, right.
There is nobody has that much knowledge. Is that basically what happens is through series of voluntary exchanges and people that want to make cash, is that people that have little bits of knowledge all get together, and create this finished product, and that's just as simple as something as simple as a pencil. So when you have something called healthcare. There are so many, many people working on corners of the knowledge and what we call healthcare that it is absolutely impossible for any attorney or any group of attorneys to actually sit down and plan what happens organically.
Yeah, and then you add that to that the complication of there's ideological differences in terms of. So you go like to some degree, what we have a common goal, which is hard enough, which is we want all these diverse people throughout this giant land to not be sick as best we can. Like we agree on that part. But then like, you know, how much do they get and how do they go about, you know, should some people have to pay for this? You know, there's legitimate ideological differences on top of already attempting something very difficult as well. And so and then a lot of people, of course, kind of like we're talking about the lawyers, have a vested interest in making it a complicated issue, even more so complicated for various reasons.
The best example I always pull out, though, is that it's not more complicated than making sure that everyone has food. And yet food is pretty much done completely privately. And with everybody looking out for their own self-interest, and we have so much food in this country that obesity is a problem. let's mull that over. And, yeah, you can do it in the break.
On the final segment of Rule of Three, we're going to get to the Golden Globes. But first, some pretty big comedy news. When you brought this up, I couldn't believe I'd sort of forgotten about it because it was like on Friday and I spent a lot of time Friday thinking about it. It was a story that came out. Was it the Daily Beast that had the story, I think?
Oh, boy. You know, I did not.
Deadspin. I forget exactly where I saw the story.
One of them.
Yeah.
One of them sites.
And it's a sort of a saga I had been keeping up with on the side, which is the big story was that this guy Dan Ninen is his name. I believe that's how you pronounce it. N-A-I-N-A-N. He is I self-identifies as from Bloomington. I don't remember if it's Indiana or Illinois. But Midwest. He's a 55-year-old fella who's a comedian. He now works out of the Washington, D.C. area. He was a D.C. comic for a while, I know. And he has been quoted something like 100 times, apparently, in various media outlets interviewing him about his opinions on being a millennial. Now, I think the real lead of the story, as it were, gets buried, which is that what Ninen did was he goes to this website called something like Help a Reporter Out or something.
Yes.
So there's this aggregate website, apparently, where reporters looking for quotes go to a website of people who just want to talk to reporters, which inherently seems like a terrible idea. Doesn't it?
I actually have a friend that went on that website and ended up getting booked on the Steve Harvey show. Is I have a friend, he's a construction worker, ex-Marine, and he collects Barbies.
Okay. That is interesting.
And has a huge collection of Barbies, and he goes to all these Barbie conventions, it's a world that I was unaware of. They actually have one here in Chicago called the Kenvention that happens every year, and I've been to a couple Kenventions.
You've been?
I have been, yes.
With your friend?
Yeah, yeah.
All I can think of is Smithers and Malibu Stacy.
So anyway, they were coming to Chicago, and I guess they had gone on that website, and they were looking for, I think they were looking for interesting conflicts, and she said that my husband won't get rid of his Barbies. And so right away, booked into the show.
Sure. Well, see, and that makes more sense to me. But when you're actually a reporter looking for meaningful, potentially insightful quotes, if you're going to basically base a story around the opinions and information you've gathered, don't go to some aggregate site where people who just want to be heard are flapping their gums. That's the laziest, worst idea. It's Adam Carolla has here's how you pick your scout leader. You get all the dads together and you say, who wants to take the boys up to the top of the mountain this weekend? And all the guys who raise their hand, they're out. You don't want those guys.
Right.
Those are the guys. You want the people who – you basically want to bother somebody as a reporter who begrudgingly tells you something, because the begrudging person is actually going to tell you something real.
One horrible thing I noticed – on Chicago TV is that we have I don't know if you know this, we have a lot of murders in
like 700 of them or something to that effect.
762 was our total for 2016. But
did the Farmer's Almanac predict it was going to be a murder heavy year?
A trend I have noticed, and I probably shouldn't know this, and I hate myself for noticing this, is that when the victim's family, when it first happens, and the reporters, you know, stick that microphone in their face and how do you feel, and you know, my baby, you know, this is completely wrong. It's, you know, just horrible catching people in that in that position, and you know, and the guy in the camera going, this is great. But what happens is when that person goes to you know, shows up with their attorney and they're going to sue, you know, such and such, that victim's family shows up. They have their hair done. But I mean, really done.
people are intuitively media savvy now.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, to the point of ridiculousness. It's, you know, they'll get a weave, they'll get nail extensions, they'll pick out an outfit, and they're like, you know, whereas before they were just in a sweatshirt when they're photographed, now they're ready for New Year's Eve.
Well, I would argue as a reporter, you always want the sweatshirt interview. That's the true interview, you know?
Yes.
And so the idea that there's a company that these reporters are like, I wonder what a millennial thinks. First off, you're so lazy, you can't just on your own find someone under the age of 35. That's a pretty
minimal
requirement.
Where are you going to find someone under age 35 unless you start knocking on people's doors and saying, you got anyone in your basement?
it's insane. So this. But what's interesting is this.
I mean, now that you don't even have to go to the store to buy a video game, now that you can just download it, it's impossible to find a millennial.
Well, yeah, no, but got the Pokemon Go. They're all walking around. Now,
yeah.
Collect them all.
Yeah.
That was what this guy was. He was. He's like, Ninen was positing himself as an expert at being under 35. So first off, even somebody who was under 35 who posited themselves as an expert at that, I would be wary of. But of course, he's not under 35. He's 55.
Well, he's been under 35 for 20 years now.
Yes. And I have what's sort of interesting from a stand-up perspective is I've been aware of this guy for a while because I am passing friends, I mean, I just mean, like friendly acquaintances, not like, you know, we didn't start in comedy together, with two of the main sources in the article, Patrick Melton and from the Nobody Likes Onions podcast, and J.L. Coven, I'm friends with through Gary Gulman. And J.L. and Melton have both had extensive dealings with Ninen, who is just a nut. I mean, there's like a slim chance that he'll look this podcast up and start bombarding me with emails. Like, he just latches. He seems to be. I won't speculate as to his mental health, but he's a sort of a serial fabricator. One of those real weird characters that only stand up comedy can draw out of the woodwork, I think.
I have two perspectives on it, and I guess they touched on this in the article. He's either mentally ill or the most brilliant comedian since Andy Kaufman.
And actually, I believe it was JL who said this. He said, if somebody was doing this on purpose as like performance art, I would say it's pretty brilliant. But the way I know Dan Ninen isn't doing that is he's not funny at all.
But again, again, the Latka Gravis character was you know, that Andy Kaufman did was supposed to be unfunny.
Yeah, but again, there's intentionality there. I mean, this Ninen guy is just a serial fabricator. And this just seems to be one of his, you know, sort of like the writer / plagiarist Stephen Glass. Just Stephen Glass cannot help himself. He just makes stuff up. And I think that's kind of this Ninen guy. Because Ninen has made all kinds of crazy claims about his kind of resume. And I mean, he's one of those guys that people on the certain comics just know about, you know, to be wary of, kind of like,
right. Well, the
legend of Luke Francis has been growing, the guy who pretended to be Scottish. I told you about that guy, right?
No, I am not aware that, you know, that's funny. There was, there was a guy, in my day that pretended to be British and did the same thing and actually played it off stage as well.
Oh yeah. I did an international comedy festival with this guy. And he was billed as being from Scotland. He spoke in the thick Scottish accent. He was the most Scottish. In retrospect, of course he's not Scottish because all he talked about was how Scottish he was all the time. And I was reminiscing with a buddy about – he got kicked out of that festival for reasons I won't mention. But I was reminiscing with a buddy about him getting booted from that. I'm like, I remember that crazy Scottish guy named Luke who got booted from the festival. And he goes, oh, he's not Scottish. And I was like, what? He's like, oh, no, he's living in the South now. And now he has a different name and he speaks with a thick Southern accent. He's doing comedy.
Ladies and gentlemen, your next comedian, please welcome Zelig.
Yes, absolutely. So there's more than one Dan Ninen out there, apparently. So beware when you read stuff. I guess it's the moral of that.
And that'll wrap too. You and me, we're young and stupid. Me and you, and we're young and stupid.
And on the final segment of Rule of Three, the big story for a variety of reasons. Today is the Golden Globes, which I suppose controversy was going to – I guess, you know, here's the thing. I was going to be snarky and say like, well, I guess if it wasn't for the Trump controversy, nobody would care about the Golden Globes. But people kind of do, which baffles me.
Do people care about the Golden Globes?
Yeah, it was all over Twitter and people you'll text me, hey, I'm sure you're watching the Golden Globes, but – and I was like, don't worry. You're not interrupting anything.
Well, the Golden Globes – are kind of like the Oscars playoffs.
Or preseason, you mean?
Yeah.
The Oscars is the Super Bowl. This is the divisional
analogy,
round.
Minor league Oscars, whatever.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's connected to the Oscars, the big event, and everyone likes to see the Golden Globes because, yeah, it is a preview of how the Oscars are going to go. Are the Oscar nominations even out yet?
No, I don't think those will come out shortly-ish.
So it's Golden Globes nominations, Golden Globes, Oscar nominations, Oscars.
Yeah, I think so.
And the People's Choice, that's the other end of the year, right?
Yeah. It's funny. If you leave the Academy to choose the best movie, they'll pick terrible movies. And if you leave the people to pick the best movie, they also will pick terrible movies. But they'll be very divergent. It's like, oh, look, Kevin James won his 9th consecutive People's Choice Award.
Well, no, isn't the Golden Globes the Critics' Choice, though?
Well, it's the Hollywood Foreign Press.
So it is the Critics' Choice. It is the Foreign Critics' Choice.
Well, the Foreign Press isn't really critics. A lot of what the Foreign Press is basically foreign entertainment journalists who really want access to Hollywood stars. So that's why this one's extra chummy. Huh. You know, it's one step removed from like the fan clubs all decide. Huh. Yeah, you know, the Academy, of course, is the Academy. Then, of course, is the actual Academy, which is more. It's all Hollywood professionals, but mostly or the majority actors, which is why movies about actors always win. And this year's Golden Globes, the big winner was La La Land, which is not a surprise since it's actors playing other actors singing about how great Los Angeles is.
Wow.
It is one of the most profoundly masturbatory movies I have ever seen. And I turned to my wife when it was over and I said, you know, I actually kind of enjoyed that. It's not a bad movie. I said, I enjoyed it. It's a fine movie. It's not that great. And it will win everything.
Huh.
Because it strokes just the right people.
Wow.
I mean, there's literally a song where they sing about how important acting is to society.
Well, I think, didn't Team America have a similar song?
Yeah, I mean, Team America basically parodies, you know, you're the best actor we've got. We need you, you know, without your acting skills. You know,
where did you learn how to act?
Yeah, right. I mean, Hollywood Land was interesting in that it is as a romance, it's a very well done romance with very appealing leads and kind of, you know, emotionally nuanced and interesting. And I liked that part of it a lot. But as a movie about Hollywood, it is so far up its own. Yeah. I'm trying to think of a funny way to say that. I thought I was going to have a good metaphor there, and I didn't. But up its own projector, as it were.
So whoever wrote that film knew exactly what they were doing.
Yeah, it was almost pandering. Intentional. Yeah, it's very pandery. And it's not very self-aware. I mean, you can, even though I liked it, you can accurately describe it as a movie about a white guy named Seb who just doesn't understand why nobody likes jazz anymore. And he meets a girl who doesn't like jazz, but he forces her to like it because he says she just hasn't heard the right jazz yet. But then she might have to leave him because she gets cast on a TV show that she says was terrible. That is an accurate description of the plot of La La Land.
Huh.
I mean, the insufferability at times is off the charts.
Wow.
I heard a great critique of it, which was Blah Blah Bland. Like, ooh, that one writes itself, doesn't it? But that won a bunch of stuff at the Golden Globes.
I had heard the buzz. I had heard the buzz about it. I was curious about the movie. But I have absolutely no desire to see it now.
You would not like it, I don't think.
No, I don't think I would.
This has been a really mediocre movie year. I've seen this just the last week. I saw Fences and Jackie, and I thought both of those were to varying degrees good but not great. Just none of the movies that year are really all that good. I don't think they should even name a Best Picture this year. I don't think there was one. Manchester by the Sea is probably as close as it came.
Huh.
And then there was subsequent controversy fired up when Meryl Streep got a Cecil B. DeMille Award or some, you know, lifetimey achievement type thing, and gave a kind of mild rebuke of Donald Trump, basically saying, you know, hey, don't be all mean because then that makes other people want to be mean, and don't make fun of handicapped people. To which he responded, you loser. to which he predictably responds by calling her an overrated actress and, you know, just the standard. I have to agree
with the Donald on that one. I've always thought that Meryl Streep was a little overrated.
I rarely agree with Donald Trump. Almost never. But it's not that she's not a really good actress. She's totally a really good actress. But people talk about her like there's no human being in history that has any point of comparison. I'm like, I don't know. Daniel Day-Lewis? Isabella Huppert?
And one thing that I don't know if anyone's noticed is all these accents she does are all the same.
Yeah, they all sound kind of vaguely Scottish-y European.
It's the Meryl Streep accent. It doesn't matter if she's Polish. It doesn't matter if she's South African. If she's German, she's doing the exact same accent. It is the Meryl Streep accent.
Leonardo DiCaprio has the uncanny ability to do a pretty good accent, but always the wrong one for the role he's playing.
Who's this?
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In Blood Diamond, it's like, I don't know what the hell country you think you're in, buddy. But you're supposed to be South African. He's like, good day, mate. We're going to get us some diamonds. Like, I don't think that's where you think you are.
Have you ever seen did we talk about the jazz singer, the Neil Diamond version of the jazz singer?
No.
Have we talked about that? Have you seen it?
No. You mean like the Al Jolson jazz singer?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, you got to see it.
He remade the jazz? I assume not in blackface.
Oh, yeah. There is a blackface scene.
What?
Why have you not seen this film? I am telling you right now that the scene in front of the fireplace where Lucy Arnaz unbuttons Neil Diamond's satin shirt and runs her manicure through his back hair is the most disturbing 5 minutes ever recorded on film.
Wow, that's quite a find. I'm going to have to YouTube that and see if I can pull up some key scenes.
But what's funny is his dad is played by Sir Laurence Olivier. and it just reeks of Sir Laurence had a payment due.
Oh, yeah.
On something. And he asked his agent two questions. Number one was how much? And number two was, do I have to remain sober throughout the filming? And apparently both the answers were correct because his accent changes through the entire film. Sometimes it's Scottish, Sometimes it's sometimes it's just him. Sometimes it's Yiddish. Sometimes sometimes it's an American accent. It changes constantly. It's like he's forgetting what accent he's supposed to be doing, and he just does not care. You can tell he does just not does. He did it for the money, and he really doesn't care about the role. It's a tremendous film.
Oh, I definitely want to see that. I always like that. Sometimes you'll see a movie, there's a Keanu Reeves movie, I think it's the bad Keanu Reeves Shakespeare, Taming of the Shrew, where like someone, clearly at some point the actor was trying to do an accent and then they just gave it up, but they kind of filmed some scenes with the accent and some without it. So it's not even that the accent goes in and out during a scene so much as that like some scenes it's present and some scenes it's not. I like that. One of my favorite bad accents, by the way, if you ever get a chance, go back and watch the preview. Go to YouTube and look up the preview for the movie The Devil's Own, which is a Brad Pitt movie from before Brad Pitt was – I've long contested. Brad Pitt was a god-awful actor up until he was a really good one, and this was during his god-awful period. And whenever I do bad – I quote it to my wife all the time, his Irish accent. We need that money, Tom. I'm not going back. It's so great. And it's just like, I would always do that voice and my wife thought it was funny. And then one time I played her the trailer and she's like, oh God, you're right. You're spot on. I'm like, yeah, it's that bad. So The Devil's Own, YouTube it.
My favorite, right? I think my personal favorite was the, what was the movie where the bombing Hitler with Tom Cruise?
Oh, Valkyrie.
Valkyrie. Yes. Yes. Tom Cruise, tried to do a British accent so he would sound German.
Yeah, or the movie Enemy of the Gates does a weird thing where they go like, all right, the Germans are going to speak German accented English, the Russians will all be British. It was like a conscious choice that they made. It's like, all right, why not? Speaking of making a conscious choice, we have to make a conscious and conscientious choice for the segment here.
All the episodes available at timslegel.com, also on iTunes.
Yep, and at brianmillercomedy.com, and look me up at Real Brian Miller on Twitter. That's with a Y, and see you next week.